NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say we've got three sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety. The Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, Piston Power, and Avemco Insurance, a world-class provider of aviation insurance.
Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Well, hello, gentlemen. It is another episode of Flight Safety Detectives. Good to be with you guys. We're going to be talking about an accident, another accident. Unfortunately, it was a multiple fatality, six fatal MU2-40, which is the short body identified as the Solitaire. And it's another sad reminder of a pilot, getting himself into a situation where not only does he perish, but he took basically most of his family with him. There is a surviving daughter who was not on the aircraft. And it's just, it is really difficult when we start looking at the facts, conditions, and circumstances to really determine, you know, where and what this pilot was trying to accomplish. Todd, you've done some background. This accident, the airplane took off out of White Plains on Saturday, April 12th, and apparently was heading not very far, 100, 110 miles, 20 miles, to a family reunion of some sort. Now, the weather was lousy, but, you know, flying an MU-2, it is a capable twin-engine turboprop airplane. It is equipped with de-icing equipment. And in fact, I have flown both the short body and the long body MU-2s, and I did a whole safety evaluation on the MU-2 aircraft for Mitsubishi shortly after I left the NTSB, and I published a report and got into a lot of detail about that aircraft. And one of the unique things with the MU-2 is that it basically flies like a jet. And what a lot of people don't know, including a lot of MU-2 owners, is that because this airplane uses flight spoilers rather than conventional ailerons, these flight spoilers make that MU-2 more maneuverable. And it's maneuverable across the board through all speed conditions. Both twin engine and single engine, or what's called OEI, one engine in op, speed regime. So it is a very highly maneuverable airplane. When you're trying to yank and bank at low altitude and you've got some speed behind you, things are going to happen very quickly. And in this particular instance, Todd, you pulled up the weather, you looked at it. And John, you're familiar with the area because you can have good weather on one side of the ridge of mountains and deteriorated weather on another side of the mountains in that particular area.
I mean, just over the hill. I drive through there all the time. And I'd be coming on the Massachusetts side, heading west, and it would be fairly nice. Not great weather, but plenty of visibility. And as soon as you go through the hills, it's about 10 miles to get through them. You get on the other side, and it's crap. And sometimes it's vice versa.
Yeah.
But that's like a clear dividing line because those hills are 3,000 feet. So they capture a lot of the bad weather on one side or the other.
thing about this airport, it's a fairly small airport, untowered, and the nearest weather observations were in places like Pittsfield, Mass, or South Albany, New York. So there was no weather that I could find within, let's say, 10, 12 miles of this location. Now, the airport has a 5,300-foot runway, which is longer than the pilot's apparent home runway. By the way, from media reports, I believe this is a family that was based out of Boston. He flew out of Norwood Airport, which has a longest runway, 4,000 feet. I used to fly out of Norwood. So this airport had a longer runway, and it had two RNAV approaches. So someone with apparently his kind of background, multi-engine, CFI, instrument rated, it should have been a fairly straightforward approach and fairly straightforward missed approach. And the thing that struck me is that this didn't seem to be a standard missed approach at all. The standard missed approach would have had him fly about 11 nautical miles north. Instead, he was making or being vectored to do a series of right turns and try and essentially do a 360 and go back to the runway.
Well, I think that's going to be a key. I mean, again, we're early into the investigation. The NTSB did a press conference Sunday night. We're taping this show on Monday, but Sunday night, a day and a half after the accident, and the information that came out was kind of cryptic and a little bit disjointed for a variety of different reasons. I'm not going to be critical because, again, we'd be here all day talking about what the board should have verified or vetted before they did a press conference. But from what we know, they were shooting the RNAV approach to runway 03. That puts them on a specific heading. And as you just said, Todd, the missed approach procedure requires them to maintain that runway heading for about 11, 12 miles to a waypoint, enter into a hold, and then be, you know, re-vectored back to the approach. Now, there was some discussion that, in fact, they were receiving vectors. We don't know what the missed approach vector may have been from air traffic control. All we know is that the air traffic controller at some point did issue a low altitude alert warning. Now, if you're conducting the missed approach, you know, you power up, you pull up and, you know, clean up, and you're climbing to 3,200 feet, and that airplane is very capable of a very high rate of climb in a very short period of time. So for them to be low and getting a low altitude alert, that was triggered because, like John said, you have hills/mountains in that area, and if he is maneuvering off the missed approach, you're going to get a low altitude alert. And looking at the flight path, based on what you've been able to decipher, Todd, it's obvious that the airplane and the pilot did not crash, but they were not flying the missed approach. And in fact, they didn't make it, what, much more than about 2 miles or so away from the airport. We don't know if they were spending in the night or just going for the day. If they had any kind of luggage on board, that too is going to add to the weight. That's going to change the maneuvering speeds for the aircraft and landing speeds and things like that. One of the other things that needs to be addressed is whether or not they had encountered any kind of in-flight icing during the course of that short trip. The NTSB board member, Todd Inman, did basically say that the ceilings were down. They were around 1,700 feet and lowering, and that when the airplane crashed, there was snow on the ground. By the time they got there, the snow had apparently melted. So it may not have been a big snowstorm, but, you know, any kind of snow event does obscure visibility. And if you have a pilot who's not going to fly the mist, or is trying to be vectored back to the airport so that you don't have to do the mist, he's called VFR or at least told somebody, hey, I've got ground reference. I'm just going to circle back around because we don't have all the air traffic control communications. And he's yanking and banking trying to get the airplane back to the airport so he doesn't have to fly out 11, 12 miles and do it all again. Now you're low altitude maneuvering in reduced visibility. And again, it's a fast airplane. It's a highly maneuverable airplane. And if you get the airplane rolled up on its side at low altitude, bad things can happen, especially if the nose falls through. Because they did, as I think you said, Todd, They got into a high rate of descent, and from the brief description from the NTSB, it sounds like they had a high energy impact.
Looking at the record of the flights of this aircraft, a lot of flights in and out of Norwood, a lot of flights in and out of Rochester, where apparently the pilot had a medical practice. But I don't see any landings at that airport or in airports in the vicinity of the crash. The closest one that he went, that aircraft went to regularly was White Plains.
Yeah, and I think another critical aspect of this is as they get information, the board member, NTSB board member, did say that they had recovered some personal pilot information. One of the things about the pilot, of course, was his certificates and ratings. So he did hold a commercial pilot certificate. He did have a flight instructor certificate, instrument rated pilot. So you would expect that with those certificates and ratings, he was fairly accomplished. He had a seaplane rating. So it's obvious that he had been doing some aviating for quite a long time. The question is, one, how much time did he have in this airplane? Because some of the initial reports, and I think you even verified, based on what the NTSB said, is that this airplane may have been purchased about a year ago by the pilot who is the owner of the aircraft. Okay, that's great. But if unless you're flying every month, to accumulate time, you can own an airplane for a year and only accumulate 12 hours of flying.
And so, looking at the data that we have, the only time it started to fly in the Boston area where I believe the pilot lived was October of last year, which is, 7 months ago, and was being flown several times a month. But the question is, for that kind of airplane, if you're unfamiliar with it, how many hours do you really need a month in challenging weather to become competent and confident in your capability?
And the NTSB also they didn't tell us what kind of avionics package was in the aircraft, but they said that it was definitely an upgraded avionics package from when the aircraft was delivered. Now, having flown both the short and the long bodies, a lot of the pilots who were owning these airplanes have outfitted them with Garmin suites, with a Dynan suite, and some of the airplanes even had Sagem, which is a French company, avionics package. It'll be interesting to really know. Now, the NTSB kind of misstated some information last night regarding the fact that these avionics suites have both volatile and non-volatile memory. And the board said that they were recovering the volatile memory. Well, that's not going to do them any good. It's the non-volatile memory that could provide and shed some light for investigators on what was going on, what was programmed in the boxes, and what the pilot may have been trying to or attempt to do. The other thing is both of you know, a lot of us fly with ForeFlight. I mean, I just went flying. I just flew a Piper Aztec the other day. And so, you know, we're using ForeFlight. You're using the moving map. You got it right there. So the board, I would expect, will be looking at, you know, for any kind of iPad and phones to see if there was any information on one of the many apps that pilots use for not only flight planning, but flight following as well. You can pull up weather and that kind of thing. So there are a lot of elements to this investigation that are currently or should at least be currently being explored. But John, you know, being up in that area and flying in lousy weather where you don't have the accuracy of a weather report at the airport, you know, you flight planned like you're always preaching with the pre-flight. You know, you're trying to get the best information, the closest information. But we all know that ATC, if you ask the question, they can provide you a lot of weather information rather than you looking down, trying to find it on ForeFlight or whatever, to at least understand what the trend of the weather conditions may be doing.
Yeah, and the other thing in this area, it's departure for Albany. They fly right over that. So he's probably worried about not climbing up into Class B airspace in that area, trying to stay under it.
Yeah, and again, I mean, you know, you're looking at data, Todd, and, you know, that aircraft was, down at 99 or 90 knots ground speed or whatever. and you'd pulled some of at least the wind reports up there.
And so given the wind, which again was in South Albany, not over at this airport, assuming it was the same wind, it would be about 100 knots airspeed. And it's no indication whether or not they were in a clean configuration or fully engaged for landing with flaps and gear down, nothing like that. So I don't know if that was sufficient airspeed given the situation. But shortly after that, they did power up, start gaining altitude, but no problem.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see what the investigators find as far as configuration. Did he reconfigure? Was he maneuvering with, you know, partial flaps and gear down so he didn't have to go through those steps and was just trying to get the airplane back to the airport? Of course, again, icing. You do have, you know, if there is ice on the aircraft, even though you've got de-icing boots, doesn't mean the airplane is clean. And so you can be carrying that extra weight if you did get through an icing event, and deteriorating at least visibility conditions with some snow and that kind of stuff. I mean, there's a lot going on. And one of the things that we talk about all the time is single pilot IFR flying is probably the hardest flying you can do because you having to do so many different things, especially when you're flying a fast airplane in challenging weather conditions.
We're going to take a short break now to meet one of Avemco's employees from their Frederick, Maryland office.
Well, JT, I understand that you have years and years of experience in insurance business, but you're here for 2 years, is that correct?
A little over 2 years, yes.
Why did you come here?
For a change of scenery, let's say. Been in the business and industry for a long time, P&C side, underwriting claims, everything, marketing. I've worked with some of these people in the past, the prior carrier, and thought it would be interesting, educational, something new I wanted to try and learn about. So I took the leap, and I love it. Absolutely love it.
So what makes you an expert in aviation, since you're talking with pilots and trying to determine whether or not Avemco is going to insure them?
Right. The pilots themselves have been my best teachers. Speaking with the pilots over the last 2+ years has been fantastic. It's such a great learning experience, learning curve for me. I've learned so much. They also, we've done ground school. We've had CFI come in, give us hours of ground school, worked in the simulator, going to the flight shows, different things, Sun and Fun, Oshkosh, do the NAFI summit, things like that, talking to the folks down there. It's been an absolutely great learning experience and a pleasure for me. I enjoyed immensely.
So what's been really the most challenging element of this business now that you're on the aviation side?
Learning the ins and outs of the planes. The underwriting side, I know how to underwrite. I get the information I need from people. But learning about the types of planes that we're insuring, that was the biggest learning curve. And I think I've got a pretty good grasp on that now from talking to the pilots and in-house education. So that was the biggest challenge, going from say commercial buildings to Cessnas or Pipers or something like that.
And now, back to the flight safety detectives.
Well, it's really, really a tragedy. It was a whole family like that.
Yeah. And Todd, you're still flying. I mean, you know, it's all about workload management. It is all about pre-planning. You know, John preaches it from a pre-flight standpoint, but you constantly have to update it. You have to anticipate, okay, if I shoot this approach and we're high or I have to go missed, you know, you've got to already have that in your head, you know, the choreographed dance of what you're going to do, where you're going to go and how you're going to get there.
No indication of what kind of distractions might have been in that cockpit. Like you said, single pilot IFR, low visibility, and that's something I personally have never done, and I've definitely never done it with people in the aircraft. It's not realistic to say, okay, everybody, be absolutely quiet. I have to pay full attention to what I'm doing here, full attention to air traffic control. If you say even a peep, I'll be distracted. Realistically, it's not going to happen, in my opinion.
Yeah, and that's a good point, Todd, because you don't know. I mean, you got 5 other people on that aircraft. Is there a physiological issue where, you know, there's a sense of urgency to get the airplane on the ground because flying out 12 miles, going into a hold, screwing around, coming back, being vectored back onto the approach, you know, that's going to be 15 to 30 minutes, depending on what's going on in the airspace. So, you know, are you yanking and banking trying to get the airplane back around? Do you really have ground visibility to be navigating so that you can get the aircraft back to where it needs to be? And again, if you get this airplane rolled up on its side and the nose falls through from a very low altitude, you're not going to have that margin of safety to recover the aircraft in short order. So there's a lot of elements to this, but it's another sad reminder. We lost a whole family in the tour helicopter in New York. And, you know, these are back to back. And a lot of people are questioning, is this the worst aviation accident year that we've seen in the United States in a long time? The statistics will bear that out. I don't think it is, but the magnitude and visibility of the accidents that are happening are what are drawing a lot of attention by the public. And in fact, I just read recently that Chuck Schumer is all over the tour helicopter in New York because they were operating a 91 part 91 FAR part 91 tour, and you know, that was the last straw for him. He wants everything to be, you know, highly regulated as far as the tour industry. It's going to be interesting to see where that plays out, and it's going to be interesting to see how the NTSB handles that, because they've written recommendations in the past based on a lot of the helicopter tour operator accidents that have happened in the Grand Canyon and Hawaii.
30 years ago, I did a tour helicopter, and I went to Hawaii, and I actually flown around and watched their operations under Part 91, and we recommended strongly that the FAA stop that exemption and require them to fly under 135. And is that going to be the answer for a lot of these accidents? No, but it's going to raise the ante. But more importantly, there's some resource issues from the FAA here that nobody ever talks about. If you have a 91 operation, the FAA assigns a single inspector to oversee a 91 airplane. And he probably has 10 or 15 of them. If you have a 135, that inspector may only have one 135 operator. So he can spend more time observing and watching what they're doing and doing his job of monitoring their operation. So that's the biggest bugaboo in here, is that the FAA, because of the 91 operation of these tour operators, doesn't get to put the oversight on them that they need, because the FAA doesn't have the luxury of people.
And right now, under the current environment, a very close friend of mine who is old school FAA, he just turned in his retirement papers. And that's unusual for him because, he was planning to stay. But because of some of the current requirements now of FAA inspectors, there's a lot of inspectors who've been around that have the experience who are going to bail. And we're going to lose that real insight, that expertise. Bringing on new inspectors right now, trying to get them trained, especially when they have very little outside operational experience to bring into the FAA, which I know of several examples right now where the FAA has hired people that were, quote, qualified, but they don't have a lot of experience out in the field. But they are in there heavy-handed, looking at enforcement actions left, right, and center. That is not going to fix any problem. Enforcement, compliance through enforcement didn't work. That's why the FAA went to the kinder, gentler FAA years ago to try and re-educate these people, work with them, work with these operators to get them back into compliance. But right now, because of what's going on, we don't have an administrator. We don't have a lot of top executives in the FAA. And now we're losing the real heart of the FAA workforce, and that is FAA inspectors. It's going to be a catch-me-if-you-can world out there with a lot of operators and pilots, just because there are no there is a lack of resources. And, that's what's concerning. And I'm hoping that again, the FAA and Congress and the administration really see that and get that part of the FAA back online in short order. But they have to get them in back online with people who aren't just going out there to look and, you know, write a violation. Because even if you write a violation, as you both know, you can have an inspector go in there and, you know, write a violation, but then it goes through the legal headshed and legal beagles go, we're not filing anything against this. We're not taking any enforcement action. So now, you know, you've got, you know, even if you have a legitimate enforcement action, now you have the frustration on the inspector's parts because they've gone out, they've done the work, they've accumulated all this information only to be told we're not going to do anything about it. And again, you know, are we really enhancing aviation safety?
This may be the first of many.
Yeah.
For oversight type in 91.
Yeah. Well,
this guy had all the bits and pieces he had. He wasn't, doesn't appear to be, he was trying to nickel and dime this operation, that flying himself around. He's flown back and forth to his practice in New York repeatedly.
And hopefully we'll be getting some new information, including possibly even seeing the video that the NTSB had referred to, which apparently showed that the airplane was, quote, still intact, descending at a high rate of speed. So, you know, we'll, as the flight safety detectives, we'll be able to do a little bit of analysis once that video becomes public and we get to see it for ourselves. And hopefully there'll be additional information that is shed regarding the operation and the pilot and the weather and everything else. John, you may be right. It all depends on what we can get from ATC to see what was going on. So,
yep. To be continued.
To be let's continued.
Hope, and so let's hope the NTSB does a good job on this one.
So with that being said, Todd, I'm going to leave you with our second to the last word.
Well, this is a, not about this event, more about what has been happening over the last few months. As many people have said in the media and elsewhere, is aviation safety in a, you know, having problems right now? Well, like you said before, it depends on what's in front of people. This event this past weekend, actually last week with the helicopter in New York, that was a global event. It happened in New York City. There was a European Union family on board. The entire family was killed. The media knows about it. We, on this channel, not too many months ago, about a year ago, we covered one event that killed a family, a Nigerian billionaire family in California. The amount of crickets you hear from the media was huge in that we knew about it. We talked about it, but there was no call from any senator or any government official to change things. There was also an air tour event in Houston a few months ago, which we talked about on this show. They ran into a radio tower, very spectacular, but the media attention was local, not global. So what does it take to perceive that safety is an issue? Obviously, bad things happening and it being in front of the media. We had a lot of that this year. But the big question, and we asked that question indirectly, is the risk we're all facing getting lower or higher? There are challenges at the NTSB, challenges at the FAA, challenges to continue to reduce risk. We're going to do our bit to fight those.
And John, with that, I will leave you with our last word.
And as usual, I will talk about pre-flight. Do pre-planning before you leave to the airport. Do it again at the airport. Make sure they agree. The weather in this case clearly wasn't great. And I don't know if he checked the weather on the eastern side of that hill, you know, the Massachusetts side. I know that there's often a difference between them. All right, he's on the south. He's south of Route 90, which is also another dividing line for weather in that area. So usually, the south of Route 90 and east of those hills is usually the best weather out in western Massachusetts. I don't know if he looked at it. If he was planning on going into this airport, he should have planned a little better. I still think he had a problem that he was going in here, expediting getting into this airport. Time will tell. The NTSB will dig that out. But anyway, for the rest of us, do a good job of pre-planning. Make sure you do a damn good job of pre-flighting the airplane inside and out. And when you get up the in the air, put that head on a swivel and remember to do and plan ahead if you have a problem. You know what? I don't repeat it in my message here, but on takeoff, if you lose an engine, you should already know what you're going to do.
Yep.
And if you're flying up on a flying the edge of these big hills in Western Mass and Eastern New York, then you should know where you're going to go. You're going to go towards the weather or away from the weather? And is the weather better somewhere else? Jesus, I go crazy with it because I get frustrated with what I see. You know, you read the reports, Todd and I go over the reports, and as you read through them, you can see where it's going. And it's so frustrating because it should have been caught early on, and these guys should not have put themselves in the position they found themselves in.
Yeah.
Anyway, pre-plan. Do what you've been trained to do and fly safely.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
Not all aircraft insurance policies and premiums are the same. As the only direct writer in the market, Avemco never uses third-party insurance agents and instead connects you directly with an aviation underwriter in their Frederick, Maryland office, ready to solve problems and to approve coverage based on what you fly and how you fly it. Avemco provides lightning-fast quotes, competitive rates, and personalized policies that are easy to read and tailored to you. Call 888-879-0389 for your free quote or visit avemco.com/flightsafety. Don't forget to tell them you're a listener of our podcast and save 5%.
Premium credits are subject to underwriting guidelines, including Avemco-recognized training and memberships.